Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Simon Horton. Simon is the founder of Negotiation Mastery. He is an internationally sought-after negotiation resource who's facilitated programs around the world for private sector organizations, government agencies, and beyond. He's a visiting lecturer at multiple universities. He's published 3 books, most recently, Change Their Minds. And that is the book that we're going to center most of our conversation around today. I've had the privilege of working with him previously. I'm really excited to dive into these conversations and share his ideas with everybody. We're going to get into many topics around persuasion, negotiation, listening. And one of the things that he talks about right out of the gate that I find fascinating is his approach to understanding that often when we think somebody else is being irrational, it's really just their version of rationality and how important it is for us to recognize that. We're going to talk about the importance of clarifying our goals up front and also asking questions that are centered around our counterpart's goals. He's going to share his 6-step process for changing people's minds, and we're going to talk about so much more. I really appreciate y'all being here today. Thank you very much. Can't wait to get Simon's conversation rolling. But before we do, want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. As always, we have HumanTel. Please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off of their best-in-class online self-paced training to develop the skills of understanding what people are likely thinking and feeling when we watch their facial expressions change or their nonverbal behavior change and leak the emotional shifts that they're experiencing at that moment in time. I've done all the training myself. I highly recommend it. It's over there at humantel.com and the code is INQUASIVE25. For any professional interviewers listening, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, both the online and in-person educational opportunities that they offer for everybody. They have the networking resources that they have, the legal updates, the job resources, so much that they have over there for professional interviewers. That's also where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? What does it take to pass the exam? And then once you have, what does it take to maintain the designation and what can it mean for your career moving forward? All of those questions are answered and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions and all of their high-value conversations. All that and more in much greater detail at inquasive.com. As always, I really appreciate you everybody being here. Thank you very much. And now without further ado, Simon Horton. Hello, Simon. It is so great to see you again. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Hey, Mike. My pleasure being here. I'm really good. It really is my pleasure. We go back a long way. We've worked together for 10 years or so back to that conference in Ireland a long, long time ago. And it's always a pleasure working with you.
Seems like several lifetimes ago at this point, but it was a great event. I'm so happy that we've kept in touch this entire time.
Yeah, me too.
Absolutely. So, I know what you bring to the table, but everybody else might be like, hey, what's Simon here to talk about today? So your most recent book, Change Their Mind, came out earlier this year, later last year. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with time.
Well, that. Yeah.
It's a recent publication. I loved it. And so we finally have the opportunity to sit and talk through your experience in general, but also kind of how it ties together in that specific book. And I'll be sure to put links in the show notes so people can find it directly and all of those things for you. But there was a sentiment you shared early in the book that I couldn't agree with more. And I'd love to start the conversation here. Time and time again, we see people try to persuade others based on the merits of their argument, what they believe to be the merits of their argument. Yet it rarely, if ever, works. So I would love to start the conversation here. Why is it so often that when we try to persuade people based on what we believe to be a rational argument, it falls short or only creates more resistance?
Look, it's really interesting that we do that. And we do, we've got our argument, we've persuaded ourselves And then we put that argument across because it persuaded us, we think it's going to persuade them, and it doesn't. And then what we do is pile that logic on more and louder, and that doesn't work either. And then we've kind of got nowhere to go. And if we, you know, if the logic didn't work the first time, it's not going to work the second time. So why is this the case? Well, on my courses, on my workshops, what I often do is I get people to, as I say, why? Take a pen. Hold that pen above your head and rotate it in a horizontal plane when you're looking up to it, and rotate it clockwise. Now, keep it rotating the same way. Bring your hand down until you're looking down onto it. And what way is it going now? And lots of people are going, what do you mean? Don't know, don't understand. But most people who do it properly, they say, oh, it's going anti-clockwise. When you're looking up to it and it's going clockwise, when you're looking down onto it, it's going anti-clockwise. And this is what persuasion is about. You see it from one perspective, they see it from a different perspective. So they see it very, very differently to you. And you're going to be saying to them clockwise. And they're going to be saying, no, anti-clockwise. And you're going to be saying, no, clockwise, absolutely clockwise. And they're going to be saying, no, absolutely not. It's anti-clockwise. Sorry for the American listeners, counterclockwise.
I'm with you.
Yeah. See, well, that's a difference in perspective as well, kind of thing. And so there are all these different reasons why, from our own history or our own outcomes, we will have different perspectives on that. And we will each think that the other person is either being willfully stupid or just obstructive or whatever. But they will think that of us as well. And so if we want to get through to them, we have to take the time to think, hold on a second, I think it this way, but they don't. Let me think, how do they see it? Ah, they see it this way. Right. Now then put your outcome or my outcome in terms of how they see it. And that is the only way they're gonna go, oh yeah, good idea, let's do it. Any other way you put it across, they're gonna say, you don't get it. So that's my explanation for why it doesn't work.
I'm 100% on board. I mean, we've talked before, you know, I'm probably gonna steal that pen example from you at some point. I'll no doubt give you credit in the beginning, but over time, I'll manage to convince myself that it was my idea. So yeah. Like 10 years from now, I'll probably never admit that I got this from you. So I'm glad we have it on video.
Hey, I stole it from another trainer, so don't worry about
it. Perfect. So the legacy continues.
Exactly.
And you mentioned the anti-clockwise, counterclockwise. Before I forget, one of the things I enjoyed about your book was how you interjected your British sense of humor into the book. Now, to you, it's just a sense of humor, but to me, it's a British sense of humor. Yeah. I've read too many books where it felt like the author was trying very, very hard to be funny, which ruined what I was trying to learn from the book. And I felt like yours was just enough in different spots to make me smile and chuckle as I went through it. So I appreciated that. There was a line in your book on this topic of my rationale versus your rationale, which didn't make me laugh and made me smile. I loved it. And I will be quoting it and I will be giving you credit for this quote, I promise. But there's a specific quote about our irrationality, their irrationality. Could you share that with the group and really kind of dive into what you mean? I think we already touched on it, but I thought it was a really powerful quote.
Yeah, it's so we think they're being irrational. Because we're so 100% convinced about our logic and how watertight it is, and we've got all of the evidence to back it up, but they've got a different logic. They've got their evidence to back that up, and we think they're being irrational, but it's not that. It's just that they've got a different rationale. We've got our rationale derived from our perspective with the evidence to back it up, but they've got a different rationale coming from their different perspective. And of course, they've got their evidence to back that up. So it is, it's different rather than wrong.
It is so critical to think that way. I recently had a conversation with one of my former interrogation colleagues, and we were laughing about, like, people are supposed to lie to you. They're supposed to protect their self-interest. Like, why are you getting mad about that? And in these conversations, they're supposed to disagree. They're supposed to have a different perspective. It's not about right or wrong. It's about their rationale, our rationale. And one of the things that I loved, and you've said it already, is how do we align those around outcomes?
Yeah.
So in your work, you talk a lot about preparation. You talk a lot about setting clear outcomes. You just mentioned a minute ago, aligning our outcome with their perspective.
Yeah.
From your work, how critical is it to be not only very clear on the outcomes we're looking to achieve, but also clear in advance of the conversation on different paths to get us to those outcomes?
Yeah, well, it's critical. Be clarity around your own outcome is exceedingly important for many reasons, not least of which is if you don't know your outcome, well, it's random whether you're going to get it or not. But the more clearer you know your outcome and what you'd like from that conversation, from that meeting, so as you say, really do that prep. What exactly is it that I want? Then the more you've done that and fleshed that out, the more likely you are to achieve it. Because, and as you said, it's having multiple possible routes to achieve it. Because you know half the answer, they know half the answer. And it's you know half the answer, but you only know half the answer. And it's only in engagement, in conversation, that you will find out what the other half of the answer is, and therefore how you can leverage that, what they want, to get what you want. One of the ways I find it very helpful in terms of that, that gives you more opportunity for different routes of maneuver, if you like, to in terms of getting your outcome, is to chunk up and ask the question, why? So I want X from this outcome. Well, why do I want X? Well, because of what I really want is to get Y. Oh, well, why do I want Y? Well, because that will enable me to achieve Z. Ah, right. Okay. So Z is what's really important. Yeah, Z is what's absolutely important. And then when we focus on that, those bigger picture goals, those strategic objectives, we've got a lot more room for maneuver down at the lower levels. If I'm going in and saying, well, I have to get X, you know, I'm insisting on X, and they're saying, well, I'm insisting on not X, then we have those zero-sum conversations where nobody wins, or one person wins but the other person loses, and therefore they make sure they get their own back the next time round, this kind of stuff. And so how do we get beyond that? We work at that higher level. In negotiation term, they're called interest, which is the answer to the question why. You want X? Oh, that's interesting. Tell me a little bit more about that. Why do you want that? Oh, because of Y. Oh, and why do you want Y? Oh, because it'll help me achieve Z. Right. Okay. Staying focused on Z is going to enable you to perhaps give up on X, but still get Z, and get Z more than you would have got otherwise.
Love it. In a quick English to English translation, Z is not just a character in Pulp Fiction. That's also the letter Z. So X and Y.
Another perspective. I should have gotten my English American dictionary out. Yeah.
You're 100% right and on board. And one of the things that I'll just call out from your book that I really loved is that you talk about when you're asking questions, ask outcome-oriented questions. Yeah. So to continue the basic analogy, instead of just asking somebody, well, why do you want X, or why is X important? It's what outcomes does X put us in position to achieve?
Yeah.
And then how does that outcome make us feel, set us up, create additional opportunities? So now that we're asking questions about the outcome, we uncover these new paths that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And you do that thinking for yourself, and you do that thinking for the other person. And as you say, in the conversations, you ask those questions of the other person. And then that just opens up so much more space for that creative solution, creative in both senses of the word, the 1+1=3 solution, where everybody is better off.
Yes. I love it. And as we're diving into your methodology, in your book, you talk about six steps to changing somebody's mind. And I don't know about you, but I'm willing to bet that in your engagements, you can't go a single break without somebody coming up to you and saying, well, how would I change this person's mind? And it has nothing to do with what you're teaching. It's their kids or their spouse or their coach or something else. So seeing how this applies to really all of our interactions, what are, in general terms, I'm not asking you to facilitate your entire seminar, what are the six steps we should really keep in mind to help someone commit to changing their mind?
Yeah, sure. Brilliant. Okay. Well, I'll do this. Before I go through the six steps, I'll just explain why I wrote this particular book, because that will kind of frame the six steps as well. So my first book was called The Leader's Guide to Negotiation. And what that did was a step-by-step framework for reaching win-win outcomes. And the research says in negotiation, win-win is the best for so many different reasons. But at the same time, there are pushbacks, legitimate pushbacks to that. And the questions I always get are, yeah, but what if the other person isn't a win-win player? Or what if it's zero sum and there isn't a win-win to be had? And these are very legitimate questions. And I did address those in the book, but obviously I didn't address them enough because people would still ask me the question, yeah, but what if they've got a gun to your head and they're evil and they've got a nuclear bomb with them as well? You know, what do you do then, kind of thing?
Stop watching TV.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, if they solved the Northern Ireland situation and the South Africa situation, I'm sure they can solve your situation, kind of thing. But they still kept going, yeah, but what if? So I thought, okay, for my next book, I'm going to interview people who negotiate successfully, consistently, in extreme situations, in the worst possible situations. So I interviewed hostage negotiators. I interviewed peace treaty negotiators, people who avoided war through their negotiations. I interviewed billionaires, psychotherapists who worked with addicts and repeat offenders, you know, the real hardest of cases. I interviewed yourself, Mike, sort of, you know, the absolute experts sort of working in interrogation and this kind of field. So where people are incentivized to not tell you the truth, you know, how do you still get success in those situations? And what was really interesting was that all of these people working independently in very different fields had quite separately developed the same method. So in all of these extreme situations, it was pretty much the same method that they had developed that they found worked in their situations. And so basically what I did is I kind of, collated that method into a six-step method. Step one was aim high. So this goes back to your point of know what you want. Step one, do your research. Think it through, be very, very clear about what you want. And I encourage people to be ambitious, aim high, you know, really go for it. Jeff Bezos didn't say, I'm going to build a bookstore. He didn't say, I'm going to build a bookstore, the best bookstore in America. He didn't even say, I'm going to build the best bookstore in the world. He said, I'm going to build the biggest and best store of anything in the world. You know, that's how ambitious he was. And so I encourage people to be ambitious. And even if they, you know, one of the beauties of this is that if you aim for that, you don't quite reach that, you only end up halfway. Because you were ambitious, you end up much further than had you gone in any other way. But one interesting point is that I also encourage people to be ambitious for the other person. So one of the people who I interviewed was a billionaire. This particular person was exceedingly bright, exceedingly charismatic, a brilliant communicator, very ambitious, all of which you might expect from a billionaire. What was striking about him was how ambitious he was for the other person. He said that people would come to him with a proposal in the negotiation, and he'd look at it and he'd say, no. No, absolutely not. We can get you much more than that. And they'd go, oh. And they'd be surprised by this, but then start processing and thinking, this is good. And he'd say, I think we can get you 10 times that. And they'd go, oh, this is really good. And now they would start working really hard for that goal, bringing all of their energies to making it happen for them to achieve their ambitious goal, and in doing so, help him achieve his ambitious goal. And that's how he became a billionaire. And this is the opposite approach to the old school approach of squeeze them down kind of thing. He said, no, I have them get a lot more than they thought possible. So step one, be ambitious for yourself, be ambitious for the other person. Step two, look for clues. Do your research. Look for clues about what you know about this person, what you know about their background, their experience, about this particular situation. Look for clues about how they make their decisions. So what is their personality type? Do we know anything about their values or these kinds of stuff? Just do that research. The more thoroughly you've done your research, the more likely you're going to get a good outcome from that negotiation, from that situation. Third one, and this one is something that this is where I interviewed you because you are the absolute expert on this, and it's about listening. And this is probably the most important step of them all. And chapter three is called Listen, Listen, Listen. I didn't even call it just listen. I had to say it three times to show how important it is. And it really is that idea of allowing psychological safety, listen to understand and not refute. Really listen deeply for many reasons, but, and we can go into all of these things in more detail later if you like, but perhaps one of the most important reasons is that people are telling you how to influence them all the time. People are telling you how they make their decisions. They leak it. Even if it's not explicit, they leak it. And so if you can pick up on these cues, you can work out, that's how they make their decisions. Right, now I know how to frame my message in such a way that they're going to say yes, because I've framed it just the way they make their decisions. So step three, listen, listen deeply. Step four is be strong. So, and again, we can talk about this in more detail, but so if one of the pushbacks, especially in an extreme situation, is that, well, if they're not a win-win player, they're a hostage taker, of course they're not a win-win player, or they're the enemy, of course they hate me, of course then I can't trust them, etc. So, how do I expect them to be collaborative? How can I make them more collaborative? Well, one way of doing that is show strength. I often say it's amazing how collaborative the other side is if you've got a bigger army than them. And the point being, you build strength and you project strength, not to use it, but precisely so you don't have to use it. So, we're talking about hostage negotiators, and we have the softly spoken hostage negotiator, usually called Denzel or Bruce, and they're on the phone to the hostage taker and they're building rapport and they're building connection, etc. But we can't forget the fact that the SWAT team is there, and that is part of the equation. And the SWAT team is there precisely so you don't have to use the SWAT team, if that makes sense, paradoxically. So if the SWAT team wasn't there, the hostage taker is more likely to resort to violence, which would require a SWAT team to resolve. But if the SWAT team is there, the hostage taker is less likely to resort to violence because they know it's only going to end one way. So they're much less likely to go down the violence route. So the SWAT team is there so that we don't have to use it. So build your strength in order to make the other person more collaborative, not to use it. If we're ending up using it, we've gone wrong, kind of thing. Then step five, and all of that then is to kind of put us in the right position that then step five, we now co-create the process. We work with the other person. We can't impose anything. They'll just dig their heels in, or even if they sign, even if they agree, they won't actually implement what you were hoping them to implement. So we co-create the process. And if they are involved in the creation of it, they will own it. And now they will implement it. Now you can trust that they will implement it. And then lastly, step six, it's kind of say it the right way. So this is where we pull everything together. And we know that we're trying to persuade two people. We have to frame it differently for each person. If we're trying to persuade the chief exec, it requires a different argument to persuading the chief financial officer. They both got different ways of making their decisions. So we pull everything together from our research, the looking for clues, the listening, the co-creating conversations, and then use all of that to frame our message in the right way that is going to work for that individual.
Try not to cut you off because there was so much I could have agreed with or jumped on as you were going through there. But even there, what you said at the end, it's creating the experience they need so they will make the decision we want. It's not how I want to say it. It's how do they not, it's not even just how do they need to hear it. It's how do they need to experience it. It's the whole thing. And you talked about context and setting the right context in your book and using all of this to your advantage. So it goes beyond the words, but it really needs to, all of your steps come down to what do they need to experience to do what you want.
Exactly that. And generating that experience is a co-creating process in itself. In peace treaty negotiations, you have the talks, but before the peace treaty talks, you have talks about the talks. So you have kind of off-channel conversations about what's the best way that we can do this that's going to be most successful. And then often, especially in really, really difficult peace treaty negotiations where both sides hate each other and there's hundreds of years of war and enmity behind that, they have talks about the talks about the talks. Because you really have to tread carefully and make sure that the process is the right process that all sides can buy into and their experience of it is going to be the experience that will lead to the right outcome.
So true. And thankfully, I've never had to participate in those conversations and I don't want to act like I have. But even if we take it down from peace treaty negotiations to interoffice situations or to new contracts, new partnerships, one of the things that we often forget is there are, on the other person's side, they have pre-negotiations. There's things they got to negotiate within their own group before they ever get to us.
Exactly.
Then there's post-negotiations. They got to go sell this thing once they agree to it with us. So if we are not helping co-create that before and after process with them, you could be masterful in the room, but they still have to save face. They still have to sell it pre and post. And if we're not helping them do that, we're failing.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll get a no. They'll say to you, yes, but ultimately you'll get a no because they can't persuade the other person. And so in my look for clues thing section, I talk about, what is their process? Who else is involved? Who else do they need to persuade? Ask them that. Ask in your conversation. Well, firstly, in the research, you think that through. But secondly, in your conversation, you'll say, look, great, it seems that you're on board. Is there anybody else that you will need to persuade that might not be on board or whatever? And then I say, the finance director might think it's a bit expensive. Oh, then you work with them. What do you think will help persuade the finance director? Because if the person you're talking to is on board, they want to get it through. And so they will want to be able to persuade the finance director. And they might not be able to, and you might not be able to because you don't know the finance director. But between you, you probably can build a case that they then take to the FD and they can get, and
like you said, co-create it.
Yeah.
I love the part that you talked about building strength so you don't have to use it. And I think in negotiation, a lot of times that strength or power can be overgeneralized into who's got the bigger hammer, right? You need to do what I tell you because I brought the bigger hammer.
Yeah.
But there are, and you write about this, there are other ways to build and project strength. It's not yelling. It's not pounding the table. It's not threatening. It's not bringing 27 people into the negotiation room.
Or interrogation room, whichever. All these different concepts all apply.
So what are ways that you work with people to help them develop and project strength that run counter to this image of having the biggest hammer or being the you know, authority in the room?
Yeah, yeah. They'll say to you, well, we're Walmart, and obviously, therefore, you have to agree to everything that we say. And one of the things that, that I talk about is that before any negotiation, I often think there's a kind of a pre-negotiation, an implicit one, one that isn't said out loud. And that negotiation is kind of, what is this negotiation about? And whose reality wins here? And whoever wins that negotiation, even if it's even if it's unsaid, wins the overall negotiation. So they'll come in and they'll say, well, we're Walmart, and therefore, obviously, you have to agree to everything that we say. And if you buy into that reality, then yes, you do. But you don't have to buy into that reality. And you can kind of respond with your own reality. They're going to be leading with their reality. They're going to be saying, we're Walmart. And obviously, this negotiation is about, or what this is about, is selling through all of our amazing distribution outlets. We've got the best distribution outlets in the world. And that's what this is all about. And if you buy into that, then yeah, you have to agree to everything. But you don't have to. You can say, well, Mr. Walmart or Mrs. Walmart, your distribution outlets are brilliant, but you know we've got a unique product here. You know how the world wants to buy our product, and we're the only people who've got it. Let's chat. So you found your source of power, your reality, and you respond with that. And power can mean so many different things. It can mean uniqueness of product. It can be extra value add. It can be expertise or knowledge. It can be personal power, just your charisma, your personal strength when you enter the room. Quite simply, how you walk into the room, you know, what and simple things like the clothes you wear and the accessories you carry, these convey something that subconsciously impact people's decision about you. So many of these kinds of, you know, it's almost limitless where the sources of power might be. And in fact, I often say, well, people often ask me, well, what's the most important source of power? And I often say it's creativity. Because it's creativity that will enable you to identify, in this situation, wow, I'm in a really difficult situation. It really does look as though they've got all their power. What shall I do? Oh, I know. And you come up with that idea. And that, your ability to come up with that idea, where is my source of power, is itself a tremendous source of power.
I couldn't agree more. And I feel like that the calm confidence comes in there as well. And that calm confidence has to come from somewhere else, of course. Preparation plays a big role in that. Experience plays a big role in that. Thinking through the agreements that you're willing to accept, the outcomes that you really need, and all these other things, walk away points, all this, you know, kind of basic 101 type stuff, all that files into it. But I truly feel that along with creativity, the often the person who is the most unsettled is the hardest to unsettle is the most unsettling. You're working really hard to get me off my rocker and it's not working. At some point you sit back and go, what does he know? Like what am I missing? And the answer could be nothing, but just the fact that you're thinking about it not right now has kind of reframed the dynamic in the room.
And I'll give you a really good story about exactly that, because it's about your ability to manage your own emotions and such, like whatever they give you, can you manage your emotional response to that? You know, so they might say something that makes you look a little bit small, or they might say something condescending to you or they might say something sarcastic in the meeting, and you could get angry and you might respond, you might show them how good at sarcasm you are, and perhaps that you're even better at sarcasm than them. Fantastic. But you've just lost your deal. So, can we manage our own emotions so that we get our outcome? And there was one of the people I interviewed for the book was a guy called Señor Juan Fernando Cristo. He was the Colombian Home Office Minister at the time of the negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas. So there was a 60-year civil war in Colombia between the FARC guerrillas and the government. And he led the negotiations on behalf of the government. Now, what was interesting about his backstory was that his father had been assassinated by the guerrillas. And he had been the Greek ambassador, the Colombian ambassador to Greece. He got the news that his father had been assassinated. He flew back to Colombia and he told me, he said, Simon, you can imagine my feelings on this plane. It was a long journey. It's overnight. I'm not sleeping at all. I have to change planes and wait for 3 hours in the airport in the middle of the night. All the time, I'm so in such anguish because my father has been killed. I'm so angry with the people who killed them. I want revenge. All of this is going through my head. And then he said he knew he had a decision to make. How was he going to respond to this? Was he going to bring this anger and this rage with him everywhere he went through life? And in doing that, ruin his own life? Or he said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use this episode as fuel for my drive to find peace in my country, in Colombia. I'm going to use this to motivate me to help build Colombia as a country where fathers do not get assassinated. And so basically he changed his political journey, and that was his journey for years afterwards, until in 2016, sitting across the table from maybe the people who assassinated his father or gave the order to assassinate his father. He signed an agreement with them and he found peace for his country. So that ability to manage all of your emotions, no matter what is being given to you, no matter what they're throwing at you, if you can do that, you're much more likely to get your outcome.
Tremendous illustration and point, and certainly helps put into perspective when somebody's just trying to get the last word at a meeting.
Yeah, yeah, yes, yeah.
Like, yeah. Congratulations, enjoy your last word.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it doesn't make that much of a difference. I don't know if there's a great segue to go from negotiating peace with the people who killed your dad. So I'm probably going to have to take a little bit of a hard turn
here.
Sure. But as I work backwards through your six steps, and when you talked about listening and you talked about looking for clues, I couldn't agree more. When you wrote down I wrote it down when you said it. You know, people will tell you what they need to be persuaded. They're telling you all the time. If it's not outright, it's within the emotions of what they're sharing. It's within the nonverbals. It's within clues that are hidden within multiple statements. They will tell you what they need to experience time and time and time again. Yeah. How we respond to those clues becomes very important. And one of the things that I loved in your book was you talked about changing from a shift response to a support response. Did I get that right? And the language that we use can either create more resistance or lead people to share helpful information so we can begin to co-create this process together.
Yeah.
Could you please explain to us the difference?
Sure. Yeah. So the shift response and the support response is two very simple differences in ways of responding. If you say to me that you've just come back from holiday and you tell me, I don't know, you've just been on holiday in, I don't know, Cancun. Okay. And I'll say, oh, Cancun, it's brilliant, isn't it? I went there last year and I got up to and I did this and I did that and I did this. And I've just done the shift response. You're in all of the glow of your holiday and just coming back from it. And I just shifted it from you to me. And you're thinking, hold on a second. I was just about to tell you what I did. And I've taken it away from that. And it's a very powerful way of losing rapport. The support response is, oh, you just come back from Cancun. Cancun's brilliant, isn't it? Tell me, what did you get up to? Or how was it? And even if you do, you know, sometimes sharing common experience is a powerful way of building rapport. So by all means say, oh, I've been to Cancun. Isn't it great? Tell me, but then go straight back to them. Tell me, what did you get up to? Or what did you like about it? What was the best bit about it?
Yeah, I love that. That quick connection of I haven't been to Cancun. Well, I've never been, but I haven't been to Cancun in 10 years, or it's been a long time, or there's been the hurricane came through since I've been there. What does it look like now? Like, that quick, it's like touch and go, and get it right back to them.
Yes.
To your point, I would love your thoughts on this. I feel like the harder it looks like we're trying to build rapport, the further away from rapport we're actually getting. Because in the beginning, people are like, oh, we're the same. Wait a minute. Why are you working so hard to make me feel like we're the same? What's going on here? Yeah. And we go from developing rapport to arousing suspicion, honestly, in a matter of 30 seconds or less sometimes.
I agree. There's an art to this, you know, and people talk, for example, people talk about matching, matching and mirroring and such like as a way of building rapport. And I do agree with that, but as long as it's done artfully. If it's done too overtly, they will notice, they will start to edge away from you and think you're a freak, you know, which is not the outcome you're after. But if you do it in a much more artful, much more subtle way, then that's and if they notice, you've gone way too far, basically. So
amen. Thank you for saying that. I can't tell you how many people, I'm sure you get it too. Oh, I think mirroring is great. I mirror people. Really, how has that actually worked out for you? You're trying to fake a natural rapport building process at a moment in time where it's natural for neither of you.
Yes.
And we're expecting that to work. I mean, I'm not saying it never worked. Clearly there's times that it has, but it's got to be done in that artful, subtle, strategic manner. I can't just start mimicking you and assume that we're now all of a sudden going to be best friends.
Yeah. No, perhaps a simple example or analogy is, let's say you meet somebody new at a networking event or whatever, and they say, hi, my name is Simon. And so it's generally good to use their names. You say, oh, hi, Simon, pleased to meet you. And then perhaps a little bit further down the conversation, you say, so Simon, what do you think about blah, blah, blah? And you use their name again, and that's nice. But if you use it every sentence, they're going to go, whoa, back off. And they will move away quickly.
Couldn't agree more. Not a direct segue, but when we were talking about the mirroring and the overusing it and the, I don't want to say false, but maybe the not fully educated assumptions around mirroring, it kind of started leading me towards ethics. Now, mirroring is not unethical, and I'm not trying to insinuate that in any way, shape, or form. I guess if you really jack it up, it could be. If you're doing it for the very wrong reasons, it could be. But mirroring of itself isn't unethical. I'm willing to bet good money that you frequently get asked about the ethics of persuasion. We persuade people every day. I would argue we manipulate people every day. That the word itself isn't unethical.
Yeah.
But when you look at what you do and how you teach, how do you believe we can continue to persuade people because it's necessary while increasing the ethics around the process?
Yeah. And I that's a really, really good question. I think the ethics is super important about this. And so you mentioned about manipulating, and I totally agree. I do think we manipulate all the time. Manipulate is a charged word, but it doesn't have to be. I can say, oh, Mike, can you pass me the salt? And I'm manipulating you to pass me the salt, okay? And there's nothing unethical about that. You got the ability to say no, and I'll be fine. Well, I might not be fine, but that is manipulating, and this is what humans do. It's the nature of human interaction. So a lot comes down to it for me, down to intention. What is your intention here? Is your intention to help them do something that is good for them? Or good for the world, and not purely for your own outcome, not purely great. If I manipulate them to say yes, I'll be able to take more money from their bank account and put it into my bank account. Isn't that great? It's about, will they be happy with that? Is your intention for good? Now, obviously, there's question marks about what does good mean? And perhaps we've all got different definitions of what good means. So I then often think, well, okay, how about this? Would you be happy if somebody did that to you? And would you be happy if somebody did that to your mum? And it's very difficult. And, you know, I'm not an ethical philosopher. I'm not a moral philosopher. So I can't define these things perfectly. And it is difficult. But I think that if you can answer those questions, yes, I would be happy them doing it to me. And I really genuinely mean that. Or I would be happy with them doing it to my mum. I do it to my mum all the time, kind of thing. Then if I'm happy to answer those yes, then it is for good. And then, do you know what? I'm happy to manipulate for good. I'm happy to manipulate. So as a coach, for example, I'm often coaching people and they're often trying to achieve certain outcomes. They've told me they want to achieve certain outcomes and they're not able to do it for various reasons, various blocks in their head or whatever. I'm quite happy to manipulate them so that they can do that, do whatever they need to do to get their outcome. It's about what works as long as it is for good. And I really do encourage people to use these for good reasons. Now, there's one other sort of kind of in terms of the checks and balances around this. Another one is the co-creation process that we were talking about. So if they are involved in co-creating it, they will now be able to say yes to that, but no to this other thing that they don't like. And now, again, you can be confident that you're in ethical territory.
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree with all of that. And honestly, as a coach, as somebody who is brought in, anytime somebody asks for help or perception or ideas or whatever, they're asking to be manipulated.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. Yeah.
They're not saying, Simon, please come manipulate me. But that's essentially what they're asking for. I'm in this exactly. situation. I need outside input in order exactly. to arrive at a better outcome. So yeah. please provide your outside input to change the track that I'm taking.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. Yeah.
And with that, when we talk about intentions, there was something else that I saw in your book that made me stop and think that all emotions really come back to two. Love and fear.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about our intentions and how we connect with people and co-creating the process and understanding where they are and they're not irrational, their rationale is different than all of these things that we've talked about, I feel come back to that. And as you were going through that last illustration, it struck me. So with the few minutes that we have left, well, I mean, we have all the time that we need really, I guess, but trying to be respectful of your schedule with the few minutes that we have left, could you please walk us through what you mean by there's really two core emotions, love and fear, and how understanding that helps us navigate these often stressful conversations where we're looking to persuade people?
Yeah, sure. So I can go at this through different ways. There is a neuroscience to this, okay? And the neuroscience basically says, in actual fact, underlying all behavior is either what they call effect, either positive effect or negative effect. Mm-hmm. Positive effect is I want to go in that direction. Whatever it is gives me positive effect. I want to go there. I want more of it. Negative effect is I want to go away from that.
Sure.
And basically, pretty much all of our decisions boil down to positive or negative effect. So that's love or fear. The neuroscience of the negative effect is the amygdala. And the amygdala is that part of our brain that when a bear jumps out of the woods, as we're walking through the woods and a bear jumps out onto the path, our amygdala goes, oh my God, that's a bear, run quickly, or whatever it tells us to do, whatever is the right thing to do when a bear jumps out of the woods. But our amygdala is always looking for fear, always looking for threats, very sensitive to potential threats, and it responds very, very quickly and very, very powerfully. And interestingly, the amygdala is triggered. I mean, these days in the corporate world or in the modern world in the cities, we don't come across that many bears, but we still have threats, and they're often psychological threats, and they're threats around our sense of self, our sense of status, and such like. And if ever these are threatened, our amygdala kicks into gear. So, for example, just the word no, if you say no to somebody, that triggers their amygdala. If you challenge their beliefs, their opinions, that triggers their amygdala. So they get defensive, they shut down, they don't listen to you. I'm going to give you some anecdotes to kind of back this up. So I've worked in Russia quite a bit. Now, Russia is quite a no trust or low trust environment. And the very first time that I was working there, it was an executive MBA program. And there were about 60 people in the room. I walked into the room, 60 people there, all huge, all looking very scarily at me. And I start talking about negotiation and I start talking about win-win. And they just shake their head. You know, they're going, Simon, that's great in Britain. It's not going to work here. This is Russia. That doesn't work here. I'm going, oh, gosh. And I'm kind of thinking, oh, I've got four more days to go through on this program. How am I going to get through this? And, you know, they're just thinking this doesn't work. But in one of the breaks, one of the people who had been one of the biggest bears of them all, who'd been sitting there in the front row and amongst all of these people shaking their heads, came up to me in the break. And he said, Simon, you were talking about trust and building win-win. He said, I trust everybody. I trust everybody. In fact, more than that, he said, I love everybody. Or if I know them, then I trust them and I love them. And I know everybody because they're human beings. And so because I know that they're human, I know what that's like. And so I love them and I trust them. Now, this particular person was the founder and the chief exec of one of the largest retail chains in Russia. Any Russian person would know that he would have bought tons of stuff from this retail chain. He was the founder. And he said, look, in a negotiation, whatever the other person says, I say, yeah. I say, you set the price. And then I agree to whatever price they say. Now, another time I was in Russia, shortly afterwards, I was talking about, actually, I wasn't even talking about that. But I was talking about leadership and I was talking about supporting your team and working with your team. And one person put their hand up and they said, Simon, do you mean love your team? And I'd never used that word and I never said anything like that. I didn't think I had anyway. But this person said, do you mean love your team? And I thought about it. I said, well, I didn't say that. But yeah, why not? Think about how amazing your team would perform if you did love them. And then I paused again and I said, okay, well, let's ask the room. And again, there was like 80 people in the room. I said, hands up here if you love your team. And again, this was a room of 80 really scary looking people who, you know, I was kind of looking forward to when the workshop had finished and I could get out of the room kind of thing. Three quarters of them put their hand up. So, and again, just to lay this on again, a little bit later, I was in another workshop in Russia and I told them this story and somebody in the audience said, can we check the room here? And so I did. I asked everybody in the room. And again, it was about three quarters put their hand up. So even in those situations where you think this is really scary, this is really scary. Why do we think it's scary? It's because they seem as though they are scary. Why are they projecting scariness? Because they're afraid. If you instead you say, actually, you don't have to be afraid, bring psychological safety to it, bring love, don't challenge their amygdala, they will then bring love. They will then bring love, and then everybody is going to be better off. You know, do this for selfish reasons, even if nothing else, do it for selfish reasons.
And that do it for selfish reasons piece, I feel like a lot of times, and maybe you run into this, like when we teach empathy or emotional intelligence, some of these other things, you know, people resist that because you want me to empathize with this other person and I just can't do it. Well, that's a choice, by the way. You can. Exactly. There's lots of ways exactly. to do it. You're just choosing yeah. not to. That's a conversation for another day. Yeah. But to your point, even if for whatever reason, I don't feel like I can empathize with this person, if allowing them to save face serves me,
yeah,
then exactly. okay, I will allow them to save face. It's
yeah, like, and as you said earlier on, you know, sort of your current approach, how is that working for you? Not empathizing with them. How is that working for you? Are you getting your outcome? I don't think you are you? Try something different. Yeah.
Yeah. And even if you do believe you're getting an outcome, are you really maximizing the outcome?
Yeah.
And how much stress and BS are you enduring to get it?
Exactly. Yeah. And even if you get it this time, you might meet that person again and you won't get it that time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, you just crammed so much intelligence and technique and perspective into an hour conversation. I'm impressed. Thank you so much.
But that's because of your clever questioning, Mike. So I know what you're like.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you. Hopefully there's a bunch of people that were taking notes like I was, and they are looking to find where they can purchase your books, where they can connect with you, where they can continue to learn from you. Where should they go?
So they want the books, Change Their Mind, and The Leader's Guide to Negotiation. They're both freely available on Amazon and any other online bookstore or high street bookstore. If they want to go to my website, www.negotiationmastery.com with a dash between negotiation and mastery. And there's lots of content on there. There's lots of videos, lots of the interviews. In fact, I think you're on there, Mike. I think there's a little glimpse, a snippet from the interview. And lots of information on there.
Awesome. Well, I'll be sure to include all of those links for everybody so they have direct access. I appreciate it.
Well, I really hope it helps people. That's why I'm doing this. I want it to help people, because I do think that this helps people. And I think once they realize that it works, they will then spread that way of working. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. There's that initial kind of astonishment / disbelief / you want me to do what?
Yeah.
And then they try it and it works. And then we're back through astonishment and disbelief. But now it's like, damn, that actually worked. So now they try it and get comfortable with it. And then it's almost like the cool secret. Like, hey, try this next time or say this next time. But don't do that. Do this. And then it's... spreads.
Exactly that. Yeah.
Oh, I know your line and time zone setting this up wasn't super easy, but I'm super, super grateful that you took the time to talk with us today, Simon. Thank you so very much.
It's really been my pleasure. Really been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Mike.
I look forward to continuing the conversation soon. Take care.
Absolutely. You too. Take care.
Simon, thank you for another fantastic conversation. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. I learn something every time, and I hope everybody listening took as many notes as I did. Thank you so much. Your thought that if we listen closely enough, people will tell us what they need to experience to be persuaded is spot on. I couldn't agree with you anymore. I also really, really enjoyed your thought of being ambitious for the other person. Not just ambitious for ourselves, but ambitious to them. What can we help them realize, understand, learn, achieve, obtain through our negotiations and beyond? I love that. And also the idea that we need to co-create this negotiation process together. One person doesn't get the chance to dictate it. This is an experience that we're going to co-create. And for most of us, that's a part of a relationship that's going to outlive these negotiations. And it's important to keep that in mind as well. Simon, thank you so much. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to the conversation. We truly appreciate you staying with us for the entirety. So much ground was covered. Thank you very much. And before we go, let's thank our sponsors one more time. Humantel. Again, please head over to humantel.com, enter the code INQUESTA25, and that will get you 25% off their best-in-class online training. If you've ever wondered to yourself, I wonder how I can quickly understand what people are likely thinking and feeling by catching their changing emotions and evaluating them in the context of the situation, humantel.com is the place to go for that training. I highly recommend it. Again, the code is INQUESTA25. For the professional interviewers, certifiedinterviewer.com is your next stop. While you're there, you can learn more about their resources for teams, for individuals, their educational opportunities, the membership benefits, the networking opportunities, and beyond. It's where you can also learn everything you need to know and get all your questions answered for the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. How do you qualify for and earn the designation? How do you maintain it? What can it mean for your career moving forward? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, head on over to inquasive.com, and that's where you can see the customized programs that our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, their sales teams, their HR teams, and beyond, to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences, to achieve new bonds and often unexpected results in all of their high-stakes conversations. All of that and more at inquasive.com. Again, thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it. Please like the show, subscribe to the show, comment on the show, share your feedback, share the show with your friends. Let them know the great conversations that we're having here and everything that you're learning from it. We really do appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so much. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.